Mancini, please. It's 7 p.m. Sunday night, and that means from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening. This is John McMullen, John Mack to some. Welcome you to the 210th episode of the weekly John Mack Radio Show. The links to the recordings of the previous 209 shows may be found at www.johnmack13.com. And John Mack is J-O-H-N-M-A-C. So that's www.johnmack13.com. Then look under the radio show tab. In addition to the previous radio shows, you'll also find links to my online daily newspaper at my web home. The newspaper is the free curation of news articles from around the country and the world, articles relating to politics, sports, books, the environment, arts, entertainment, opinion, and technology. Try it and subscribe only on one email per day. And once again, it's free. Before proceeding, as regular the listeners to the show are aware, one of the regular contributors to the show is my longtime friend, John Charles Chick Dunnigan, co-author of The Greatest Beer Run Ever. Chick appeared at the benefit for our mutual drama school, Good Shepherd, in the English section of Upper Manhattan this past Tuesday evening, October the 17th. Between 200 and 300 people attended and made the $25 donation, which will go completely to Good Shepherd, as Chick donated all of the books, a few hundred. So an autographed copy of not only Chick, but of the four people he delivered the alcohol to, his co-author, and then him were handed out. And there were also drinks courtesy of the Good Shepherd Men's Club. If you did not have an opportunity to get there, and if you're interested in the book is available on Amazon, or if you're interested in making the contribution to Good Shepherd, you can Google it. I hope you'll join us not only tonight, but every week at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on Sunday evenings, live, or as most do, listen later. My guest next week will be poet John Capriolan, author of 366 poems, my year in verse, and a member of the Mayapack Poetry Workshop. Now, to this week's show, the 210th, as I mentioned, callers may call in at any time during the show by dialing 646-716-9756. Then once again, that's 646-716-9756. I normally hold callers until near the end of my interview with my guest. My guest tonight is poet M. Grout, college professor, author of Victory in Winter, and the coordinator of the aforementioned Mayapack Poetry Workshop. Dan's poems have appeared in a number of well-known journals, and additionally, she reviews the lyric magazines and poetry, the New Pages. In the course of our conversation this evening, we will have an opportunity to hear some of Ann's poetry. Good evening, Ann. Welcome to the show.
Hi, I'm really happy to be here.
Good. Well, we'll start right off. Where'd you grow up and go to early school?
I grew up in Kansas. I was born in the southeast of Kansas, but I grew up near Kansas City.
Do you remember what your earliest aspirations were?
Oh, my. I do remember wanting to be a marine biologist and not having an ocean.
That's funny.
When I was a kid.
Do you remember the first time that you wrote anything?
I started writing poetry in my teens, probably somewhere around age 15. I kept journals for a long time, since probably the age of 12, but decided that poetry might be my calling after reading some in my English class in high school.
Where did you go to high school?
Blue Valley High School in Stanley, Kansas.
Okay. And then to college where, and to study what?
I decided to go to Kansas State University. They had a literature and creative writing degree, and I was anxious to get on the road to being a poet. So I decided to go out to Manhattan, Kansas, and attend college there.
Were you writing for school publications while in high school and college?
In high school, I entered a fiction contest within my school and won, but I didn't really publish anything during my college years. I did send out a few things, but I was focusing more on becoming a better poet.
So from the beginning, even though you won the fiction contest, you're going to concentrate professionally on poetry then, I guess.
Yeah, it seemed to be something that I felt I might be better at.
And then after college, what'd you do?
Well, as I was about to graduate from K-State, I wasn't sure what I would do with a Bachelor of Arts in Literature and Creative Writing. And I happened to open up the college paper and said that Peace Corps recruiters were going to be on campus and to interview people who might be interested. So I decided to go meet with a recruiter, and I ended up joining the Peace Corps and teaching in Kenya.
Yeah, how long were you in Kenya for?
3 years.
Hey, Jim Casey, who's in our writers group, his wife was in the Peace Corps, and she was in the mountains in Brazil someplace, and she picked up the virus that they think may have affected her to this day. So it's I'm sure that many of the volunteers put themselves in some jeopardy wherever they were in the world.
Yeah, even when I was in Kenya, I did contract malaria a few times, mild cases, fortunately. So, but there are things that can kind of stay with you if you encounter them.
Did they have decent healthcare facilities to treat the malaria while you were there?
Oh, yes. The hospitals were very good. Even the ones that were kind of upcountry, most of the time they were run by churches or mission groups or other, I guess, NGOs. And the healthcare was quite good.
What was your day like there, and your week? What did you get to do? It must have been very different experiences than you obviously have in the United States. What did you take away with you from your Kenya?
Well, I learned that I could live without electricity and running water for quite a long time, and I could adapt to whatever situation might come up. I lived at the school, so I had a house that was part of the deal with Peace Corps, that the country provides a house, but they don't have to pay the volunteer, of course. That's taken care of by the U.S. government, by the Peace Corps. So I would get up in the morning and prepare to teach. I taught in an all-girls boarding school, and I could hear them getting up. We'd get up very early in the morning and they would collect water. But I learned how to live without a lot of things that I would have thought I couldn't live without.
Does any of your poetry deal with your time in Kenya?
I do have a few poems about that experience. It's a little hard to write about, though. Now it's so many years ago, but it's hard to get just the right words, I find, for it. But I keep trying.
Do you have anything handy that you could read to us about that period of your life?
I think so. Let me see if I can. I don't know. I'm sorry. I didn't have these ones right.
Okay. Rather than return to Kansas, you entered grad school in New York City. It seems to me that within a five-year time span, you went through more cultural change from Kansas to Kenya to New York City. What caused the relocation to New York?
Well, I wanted to attend Teachers College at Columbia University, and I had met my future husband in Kenya, and he had been living in New York City, and I had always wanted to move away from Kansas, so I felt it was just a good time to do that after I returned from the Peace Corps and didn't really have any responsibilities quite yet, just me. So I moved to Brooklyn and started attending Teachers College.
What did you study at Columbia?
The teaching of English at the college and high school levels.
In one of my own poems, I quoted the great Joyce Carol Oates, who said that there are an equal number of people who write poetry as there are who read it. I then quoted one of our ex-poet laureates, Billy Connolly, who disagreed, saying that more people write it than actually read it. If either are right, it's obviously a difficult way to make a living. Did you go into teaching to support the writing career, or did you get very serious about writing professionally later?
The teaching was what was going to sustain me, financially. And I thought, well, on my breaks, I could work on poetry. I can even do it during the year. I could always be talking about poetry and reading it with my students, as well as fiction and other works, but which is something I love to do. I love teaching literature and talking about literature and writing about it.
Do you have anything handy that you wrote during that period about what you were doing?
Which period?
The grad school period.
No, I did find one about my Kenya experience.
Okay.
But I don't really have one from that study period. Okay, this one was not written in Kenya, but after. I find that reflecting back on experience with some distance of time helps me create poems. So this poem has an epigraph at the beginning as well. The epigraph is, I was only one syllable of only one word, but what was the word? Who was uttering it? And to whom? And that's from The Blue Bouquet by Octavio Paz. And the poem is called Metaphors. So this is Metaphors. They were eyes, not flowers, in the story she remembered. Nothing seemed to make sense, not the surrealists, not her surroundings. A mahogany bat flew in from the charcoal pitch of a moonless dark. A small sorrel cow stumbled through the kitchen door. An ashen stick grew legs and sprouted amethyst orchids for wings. A snake writhed so green she had no better word for it. The armored insect putting up a night-long battle with her fear. The wasp mother resurrecting a nest each day in the rafters. The safari ants claiming her toes while she hung shirts soon eaten by goats. The goats gathering on the porch to escape from the rain. Drinking the fresh rain from a cup held under the bent gutter. Hearing the crested cranes settling in at night on the pond. Listening to the wails of Kenyan Luo women mourning in the darkened village. Recording the sound of uncompromising rain falling on corrugated tin. The sound engulfing her voice in her letters home.
Whole new experiences that never found in Kansas or in Brooklyn. I guess that was a...
That is true.
That was eye-opening with the insects and with the animals and everything.
Yes, a lot of that was very true. I had that armored insect was huge, and I couldn't figure out even what it was.
Yeah, we even had that in the United States. We had a place in Hilton Head for about 10 years, and when and one morning there was these giant bugs in the apartment, that these palmetto bugs that we'd never heard of, you know. I said, where did these come from? They look prehistoric. Tell us about your teaching career. Did you begin in high school and then move to college, or were you doing both from the very beginning?
My first teaching job was in New York City. It was teaching at-risk teenagers who had either dropped out or had to leave high school for one reason or another. I taught in a youth service, but for a public school that supplied the teachers. It was called Offsite Educational Services. So I was paid by the city, but placed in a private youth service to teach at-risk students.
There's so much more with at-risk students than that. I remember having one friend who talked about, when we were in grammar school, that special education was one across the knuckles. And the fellow that I mentioned earlier was this book, who also now has the master's from Harvard. He didn't find out that he was dyslexic until he was 73 years old, or 72. So, you know, we go out of our way anyhow to try to at least equalize the opportunity, if not the outcomes. And I think that's terrific, but very often it's very difficult for the teachers. Did you have difficulty in these classes?
It really was a trial by fire at first for my first teaching experience. I had to find ways of getting students to read who didn't want to have anything to do with reading. Some of them were there on condition of parole. Some of them had lost all faith in education. And so coming up with different ways of reaching them was the challenge. And it was difficult at first, but I worked there for 4 years and it was very rewarding.
And then where'd you go?
See, where did I go? Oh, then we had moved to Ossining, and I applied to Ossining High School and just happened to get a job a week before school started. 1 year, they called me. Someone was not returning, and I was able to work at Ossining High School. I think that was around 1994.
And at some point, you moved to colleges, both online and in the classroom. How did that happen?
Well, at Ossining, as an Ossining high school teacher, I was very fortunate to be able to teach the Syracuse University classes that they teach to high school seniors in their Project Advance. And when you do that, you are hired as an adjunct. You're not paid because you're paid for your job as the high school teacher, but you have the privileges of an adjunct instructor at Syracuse. And so I was teaching college level in the high school. So
okay.
That got me. The bug bit me and I thought, oh, I can do this.
And then did you aim for college after that, or did you continue teaching high school?
Well, I stayed for a while. I had two small children, and we had moved up to Mayapak, and it was a little bit difficult commuting and keeping the children in daycare without them getting sick. And so I decided to take a leave of absence that they granted me. And while I was home, I thought, let me try to figure out something I can do from home. And I went on some websites, and I put my resume on Monster. And pretty soon, University of Phoenix contacted me and interviewed me for a position as an adjunct. And I got that and then worked there for 13 years.
I've heard both good experiences and bad experiences there. The bad experiences were from some people that I taught with at Monroe College, and they felt that they were shoehorned into a particular both curriculum and everything week by week, whereas they were used to doing more things as the college teacher might at Monroe. What was your feeling about the experience?
Well, I taught the first year writing courses. So composition, and I was also fortunate to be able to teach some literature courses as the University of Phoenix expanded from being only a business school to embracing the humanities. So I taught the first year students composition 1 and 2, and I think most of my students understood that they needed to take these courses to move on. They were requirements. And I had a very good experience, but I do know that there have been problems with the University of Phoenix, you know, in the past with some students, and they've been under investigation and stuff like that. So, but my experience with my students was pretty positive most of the time.
I taught for years at the college level, mainly in the technology field, when my students wanted to learn skills for their life's career. But when I taught more basic and required courses to students not wanting to be computer professionals, I found resistance to having to take such courses and the much lower level of interest. Did you find a similar challenge in teaching English and literature courses?
With writing, though, it's easy to explain why they need it, because they're just starting out on their college career. My students now that I'm teaching at Manhattanville, it's their first writing class, and they're not all enthusiastic about it, but they know that they need it because they're going to be writing papers in nearly every class they take. So the beginning.
Do you have any writing on this subject, teaching at either the college or the high school level?
No, I generally don't write about teaching very much. I don't think I have any poems about teaching.
You also got very heavily into publication by this time, publishing in various journals and everything, and the chapbook. When did you begin writing heavily? How did you make the contacts? And what were some of the publications in which you've appeared?
Well, a few years ago, when I started taking workshops at the Hudson Valley Writers Center, I was encouraged by the teachers there to send out my work, and they were very generous with their knowledge of how it all worked. And my wanting to be published for so many years and wanting to make it happen, it just came at the right time. I guess I started taking courses there in 2011 with Amy Holman and then Kathy Ossip and then Barbara Fisher. And in each class, I was encouraged to send my poems out. And as I started learning more about poetic techniques from these experienced poets, I found I had some poems that were accepted in some online journals and a couple of print journals and a few anthologies.
The Hudson Valley Ride Descent is just a wonderful place. It's for those in the audience who aren't aware of it. It's the they own the old New York Central station in Sleepy Hollow, New York, at the Flipsie Madison station, and they constantly have things. They have classes. They have open mics. They have workshops. They have the ability of people who have just been published to promote their works. It's just a terrific place. How did you happen to find it in the first place?
I think when I was living in Ossining, I must have seen a flyer or something. I'm not sure. I started going actually years before 2011. One of my professors from Columbia Teachers College was doing a workshop at the Hudson Valley Writers Center. So I decided to take her workshop. But that was long before I started my second wave in 2011. I just decided then, you know, I knew it was there and I thought, oh, I should just go and do this.
What are some of the journals that you've been publishing?
Online, I've been published in the Newverse News and the 5-2 Crime Poetry Weekly. Those are two favorites. I've also been published in the Plath Poetry Project, which is an online poetry project concerning Sylvia Plath, and Rivet Journal, which is this just, I just love this journal. It's very edgy and some wonderful writing in there, and I was fortunate to have an editor who liked one of my poems. So I've been published in Rivet Journal and Random Sample Review.
Tell us about the crime place. People might not be aware that there are many groups around of all sorts of particular interest, and the crime one's one of the more interesting to me. Tell us about that.
Yeah, this one was told to me by Amy Holman in one of my first workshops with her. I was working on a poem, and she just felt that that's where it could be published. And so I sent it, and it was accepted, and that was my first foray into online publishing, was at the 5-2, which I think is just a wonderful online journal that publishes a poem every week and keeps it up all week. And the editor is generous with his publishes or publicizes it on Twitter and on Google Plus quite a lot.
Jamie Holman, by the way, has been the guest on this show, and she's a terrific person. She comes all the way in from Brooklyn to teach in Sleepy Hollow. Do you by any chance have that poem or other poem that you can read to us from that period?
I do have one poem that was published on the 5-2, Andy.
Good. Why don't you read it?
It's called First Grade Criminal. She knew she had not done something wrong, her knees reddened by the knobby carpet that hid the hard linoleum, cold and gray, that was probably white once. She had written on her desk with blue marker, and now that desk scrubbed clean was gone. No desk until the second grade, so far away, replaced by stares and glares from teachers passing by, other kids. Her teacher grinned, the toothy grin of Cruella de Vil, acted nice in front of others, reminded them that transgression was rewarded with pain, humiliation of a pariah. And one must learn, even at 6, that consequences exist for every action and that someone else is always in charge. She thought her teacher might have a dungeon at her house or beneath the school. She searched for the trap door, always looking down to avoid it, the inevitable dropping into the dark that would most surely be reported to her mother, who asked about her every day, and whether school was good. She always replied that it was fine, and if it would be okay, she would like to start wearing long pants to school instead of the dresses she had picked out at the store, at the bright back-to-school counter, where all of the possibilities of first grade had shown right in front of her.
That's terrific. I know of growing up through these different schools. I remember having rope around me, holding me to a desk. I didn't mind at all. I knew it was part of the game, and I was very bright in grammar school. So I knew that if I didn't want to get C's in conduct, that I could just stop talking. It wasn't worth it to me. So I paid the penalty, but to me it was part of the game. The ones that I felt bad about, they were the ones who didn't do well in school and grade-wise, and then they had some kind of punishment, or they had less than the other people, and that wasn't going to make them any smarter. It wasn't like me that it was just going to say, hey, if you don't want to have this punishment, just straighten out. They couldn't do any better. So that's interesting. Do you have another one from there?
I don't have them right handy, but I can find them pretty quickly.
Okay.
Let me see if I can. I'm not sure.
I know that you've taught both courses, both in person and online, as I have. Where do you find the greatest challenge, and why?
The challenge, I'm sorry, of what?
The online course versus the in-class course. I know that you've taught online both the University of Phoenix and New Hampshire, and you've obviously taught at Manhattanville in the classroom. What are the differences, and which do you find more time consuming?
They're both time consuming, but in a different way. Working at home has its drawbacks as well as its advantages. Now that I work, in a face-to-face classroom, I have a commute, which I didn't have for years. And I have to be in front of a class for an hour and 15 minutes, when in an asynchronous teaching environment online, you can go in any time of the day or night and participate. So there's more flexibility of schedule with the online teaching.
I found with the online, though, that you didn't have the ability to know if the third person in some column wasn't getting it because they weren't, you could tell, whereas online you couldn't tell. So you had to have heavy assessment, more quizzes, more reports, more things to do. So I found that more time consuming, more challenging, because it wasn't just your personality that could carry the class. I wonder if you felt anything like that.
Yes, there were a lot of assignments because you had to cover a lot of things that you might have covered in a face-to-face class just in discussion, but everything has to be in writing in an online classroom. So in the online classroom, there is much more to grade, much more to read. It is very time-consuming. I think once I found strategies for teaching different things and for grading effectively and efficiently, that it got easier.
Were you able to find any more crime poems while we talk?
Yes. I found the first one that I wrote in Amy Holman's workshop after I had written about a tree, and it just wasn't gelling. The poem just wasn't coming to me. I was trying to write about a tree that had been cut down, but what I did was I started looking up newspaper stories about trees, and I ran across a story of a murder in South America of two activists, Jose Claudio Ribeiro da Silva and Maria de Espirito Santo. They were killed because they were trying to save the rainforest. They were going up against the loggers. So this poem is called The Death of the Nut Harvester. Your murder was premeditated, long planned and financed, benefiting pharmaceutical companies, loggers, and landowners. Your ear was sliced off by hired killers, stuffed into a pocket, a trophy, and proof that you were no longer a threat to the moneymakers. Your body, riddled with bullets, next to your wife's stillness, lay on the forest floor, nourishing the soil.
Wow. I have a friend that I know from the local Barnes & Noble, where I tend to hang out with other people, including Jim Casey from the class. And this fellow works in Guatemala for NGOs. And Guatemala has a whole history of what was called the unremembered or the dispossessed, thousands and thousands of people mass buried that were the dissidents, the Indian population there, that were just wiped out. It's very different being in a situation like that, obviously. Yeah. The Mayapak Poetry Workshop is the new endeavor, and you became the first coordinator. Please tell the audience both about the group and how you got involved.
I'm always looking for ways to keep poetry coming into my life. So I like to meet in groups, and I thought it would be a great idea to establish a little community of poets in Mayapak and Carmel. Maybe some people I haven't met yet who write poetry and have a love for the word, the written word. And fortunately, we have such a great group.
Well, I don't know about that, but we all care, and some write well, you know. So that's interesting. Yeah, we only meet monthly, whereas the writers group that Vinny runs, that I belong to, meets weekly. I wish that we met at least twice a month, but that's the way it was laid out. So. I guess
right.
We can't do much.
I had asked them about it, and I'm not sure if the room is available more than once a month, because I think there's a lot of use of the library rooms. So.
That is a wonderful library. It's right on the lake. It's just very nice. They've got very nice programs and everything. I really think they work at it. You're also involved in the group in Katona. Tell us about that.
It's a group of poetry friends. We've been in workshops together, and we like to get together and share our poems and help each other with any poetic dilemmas we might be in. We meet when we can and to help each other write poetry. We like to write together. We usually come in with lots of poetry prompts and share them.
Tell the audience what the poetry prompt is.
It's just something very basic that gets you writing. For example, you might say, write a poem in which every line ends with a word that begins with the letters of your name. So you write your name down lengthwise, but instead of starting the line with it, it's the last word. And then you write kind of, you choose the words that begin with the letters of your name and then write toward those words. That's just one example.
And you also mentioned this Sylvia Plath group that it's all about her stuff, right? And you use an example in the Madpack group about having to write the poem that only used words that appeared in one of her poems.
I was part of a poetry challenge a couple of years ago during National Poetry Month in April, and they're usually poetry challenges crop up online for National Poetry Month. So I joined one, and it was like a private Facebook group, and the parameters were to write found poems from one source, like one book. And I chose Sylvia Plath's The Bell Jar and created a poem a day for the month of April that only used text from her novel.
Wow. That must have been challenging.
It was, and it was invigorating as well, and then it eventually became my chapbook.
And tell us about the chapbook.
It's called Fig Tree in Winter, and every word is taken from the pages of The Bell Jar. I just rearranged them to make new poems.
And is it available on Amazon?
No, it's available through the independent press, Dancing Girl Press. I think it's just
okay.
dancinggirlpress.com.
Okay. And you'll send me the URL. I'll put it in the release about the show. That's terrific. How many poems are in the book?
30. I was fortunate to be able to include all of them that I had written that month. So,
can you read one for us?
Do you want to hear one? Did you say? I'm sorry, I missed that.
Yes. Could you read one for us?
Okay. Sure. This one is called A Bitter Atheist. The graveyard disappointed me. I could smell the stagnant salt marshes in the distance. Cobwebs touched my face with the softness of moths. The earth seemed friendly under my bare feet. The tatty wreckage of life rushed me to sleep. A cool wind rushed by. The silence surged back. It was completely dark. I knew just how to do it. Tugged my black veil down to my chin and strode in through the wrought iron gate.
Wow. Can you do another one then, right after?
Oh, sure. Let's see. This one's called A World Divided. A man's world is different from a woman's world, and a man's emotions are different from a woman's emotions. The best men wanted to teach their wives about sex. My mother said this was something a girl didn't know till it was too late. I felt moved and tender and perfectly certain it might be nice to be pure. When I was 19, pureness was the great issue. I thought a spectacular change would come over me the day I crossed the boundary line. I woke to the sound of rain. I heard somebody breathing. It was pitch dark. I held my breath. I lay in bed listening to the rain. I wanted to shoot off in all directions.
I like it very much.
Thank you. The novel is a beautiful place to find poetry.
What's next?
I do have another chapbook manuscript, and I'm working on poems about the wives of Henry VIII for a possible collection that uses primary and secondary sources to tell the stories of the wives.
of Henry VIII.
We have one caller on the line who I told before the show that I wouldn't push him into speaking because there's laryngitis. He's the fellow that that just did the benefit at our grammar school and donated the books and sold about 200 of them to benefit the school. I'll give him the chance if there's anything he particularly wants to ask, but I won't want to push him into talking. Good evening, Chick. Is there anything you'd like to say before I...
No, John, there's nothing I really like to say except to admit that since I've been listening in on your radio show, I've never even given thought to poetry except for a period in my life where I got to know Seamus Heaney. And when I was... I didn't know whether he was speaking as a poet or just a guy at the pub. And we were talking about whatever was going on at the time. But it's interesting listening to people talk about something that obviously is part of life. And I never paid any attention to it. I'm 76 years old, and I'm learning something new. That's all I have to say. It's enjoyable.
Not even the poem that I wrote about you in the Broadstone, Chicky Goes to War, huh?
No,
okay.
Not even that.
Okay. We've covered a good deal of ground tonight, Ann. What else would you like the audience to know about you?
That's a hard question. I don't know. I just continue to write and teach writing and hope that I can continue till forever. As long as I'm breathing, I hope to be writing. So.
You said that at least one of your daughters wasn't turned on by poetry. Has she come around?
She'll read it, but it's not her favorite thing. But she's a fiction writer.
Oh, okay. Is she also published?
No, not yet. She's working on a novel, and she's going to college, so it's going to take a while, I think.
Okay. And is your husband literary, too?
He reads all the time, but he has different interests. His is mostly in nonfiction, politics, history, but he'll read my poetry.
Okay. Well, that's good. Thank you very much, Ann. It's been a real pleasure.
Yes, it's been wonderful. Thank you.
A bit of commercial information. My books are available at Amazon, and I've blogged at medium.com and published the daily newspaper mentioned earlier. Send any comments or questions to me at johnmack13@gmail.com. And in the words of Mets road announcer Howie Rose, after the Mets win, which there weren't enough of them this year, put it in a book. I hope you'll join us next week and every week after at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on Sunday night. And I'm going to take us off for Count Basie.